again, nausea-free, then we'd really need to double down on the only eating apples diet. The only real cure for fatness was to go back in time and not get fat in the first place. I started to cry, and then I started to laugh. What the fuck kind of a life was this? Around that time, just when I needed it, Leonard Nimoy's Full Body Project came to me like a gift. The photographs are in black and white, and they feature a group of fat, naked women laughing, smiling, embracing, gazing fearlessly into the camera. In one, they sway indolently like the Three Graces. In another, they recreate Herb Ritz's iconic pile of supermodels. It was the first time I'd ever seen fat women presented without scorn. I clicked. I skimmed. I shrugged. I clicked away. I clicked back. I was ragingly uncomfortable. Don't they know those things are supposed to stay hidden? I haven't been having basement sex with the lights off all these years so you could go show what our belly buttons look like. At the same time, I felt something start to unclench deep inside of me. What if my body didn't have to be a secret? What if I was wrong all along? What if this was all a magic trick and I could just decide I was valuable and it would be true? Why, instead, had I left that decision in the hands of strangers who hated me? Denying people access to value is an incredibly insidious form of emotional violence, one that our culture wields aggressively and liberally to keep marginalized groups small and quiet. What if you could opt out of the game altogether? I paused and considered. When the nutrition teacher emailed, I didn't sign up for the next session of Almond Gulag. I couldn't stop looking. It was literally the first time in my life that I'd seen bodies like mine, honored instead of lampooned. Presented with dignity instead of scorn, displayed as objects of beauty instead of as punchlines. It was such a simple maneuver, but so profound. Nimoy said of his models, "I asked them to be proud." For the first time, it struck me that it was possible to be proud of my body, not just in spite of it. Not only that, but my bigness is powerful. I hate being fat. I hate the way people look at me or don't. I hate being a joke. I hate the disorienting limbo between too visible and invisible. I hate the way that complete strangers waste my life out of supposed concern for my death. I hate knowing that if I did die of a condition that correlates with weight, a certain subset of people would feel their prejudices validated, and some would outright celebrate. I also love being fat. The breadth of my shoulders makes me feel safe. I am unassailable. I intimidate. I'm a polar icebreaker. I walk and climb and lift things. I can open your jar. I can absorb blows, literal and metaphorical, meant for other women, smaller women, breakable women, women who need me. My bones feel like iron, heavy but strong. I used to say that being fat in our culture was like drowning, in hate, in blame, in your own tissue. But lately, I think it's more like burning. After 3 decades in the fire, my iron bones are steel. Maybe you're thin. You hiked that trail and you're fit and beautiful and wanted, and I'm so proud of you. I am so in awe of your wiry brightness, and I'm miles behind you, my breathing ragged. But you didn't carry this up the mountain. You only carried yourself. How hard would you breathe if you had to carry me? You couldn't, but I can. I was hooked. Late at night, I started furtively clicking through fat-positive tags on Tumblr, like a Mormon teen looking at internet porn. Studies have shown that visual exposure to certain body types actually changes people's perception of those bodies. In other words, looking at pictures of fat people makes you like fat people more. Eternal reminder, representation matters. I discovered a photo blog called Hey Fat Chick, now crushingly defunct, run by an effervescent Australian angel named Francis Lockie, and pored over it nightly like a jeweler or a surgeon or a codebreaker. It was pure, unburdened joy, and so simple. Just fat women, some bigger than me, some smaller, wearing outfits and doing things and smiling. Having lives. That's it. They were like medicine. One by one, they loosened my knots. First, I stopped reacting with knee-jerk embarrassment at the brazenness of their bodies, the way I'd been trained. I stopped feeling obscene, exposed, like someone had ripped the veil off my worst secrets. Next, they became ordinary, mundane, neutral. Their thick thighs and sagging bellies were just bodies, like any other. Their lives were just lives, like any other, like mine. Then, one day, they were beautiful. I wanted to look and be like them. I wanted to spill out of a crop top, plant a flag in a mountain of lingerie, alienate small, bitter men who dared to presume that women exist for their consumption, lay bare the cowardice in recoiling at something as literally fundamental as a woman's real body. I wasn't unnatural after all. The cultural attitude that taught me so was the real abomination. My body, I realized, was an opportunity. It was political. It moved the world just by existing. What a gift. The Red Tent. In August of 2010, the stranger got an email from an organization called Vashon Red Tent, advertising that, quote, a Red Tent Temple Sisterhood is coming to Vashon. Vashon is an island accessible by ferry from Seattle, mainly populated by NIMBY-ish hippies, NIMBY-ish yuppies, boutique farmers, and wizards riding recumbent bicycles. A full quarter of the children in Vashon schools are unvaccinated. The Red Tent Temple movement, the press release read, envisions a gathering honoring our stories and promoting healing in every town across the country where women of all ages meet regularly to support one another and monthly menstrual cycles. The only thing I knew about Anita Diamant's novel, The Red Tent, which inspired the movement, was that one time my college roommate read it and then announced to the rest of us that she wanted to go, quote, bleed into the forest. It didn't feel like a good sign. This event, clearly, was my worst nightmare. The paper, clearly, RSVP'd for me immediately. I dragged my friend Jenny along with me, and we barely made the ferry. On the bench next to us, there was a woman with long, frizzy hair and high-waisted jeans. She was wearing a t-shirt with a picture of cats in sunglasses playing saxophones, and above the picture it said, Jazz Cats. There are a lot of different ways to be a woman, I wrote in my notebook. Jenny and I were running late for Menzies Tent, but we stopped by the grocery store anyway to buy some boxed wine and anxiety jelly beans. We sat in the parking lot and wolfed beans and got as tipsy as we could in the time allotted. My sister is into this sort of thing. She loves ritual. She's forever collecting shells for her Venus altar, or tying a piece of ribbon to a twig in a secret grove, or scooping magic waters up into very small vials to make potions. Being around my sister feels magical. When we traveled through Europe together, following the path of Mary Magdalene, doyi, we didn't miss a stone circle or a magic well, tromping over stiles and up tors, and always leaving little offerings for the fairies. Once, in Cornwall, we looked down into an aquamarine cove, and she said, "Do you see the mermaids? They're sitting on that rock." I said, "No," and she looked at me with pity. On the way to the Vashon Red Tent Temple, I texted my sister for advice. "I'm on my way to a new moon celebration at a Menzies temple," I said. "Liar," she said. "It's true. Any tips?" "Stay open to a new flow and wave goodbye to the blood of old that nurtured you well." I knew she'd know what to do. I almost didn't go in. It was too intimate and foreign, and I am clinical, like my mom. I like magic as escapism. I barely tolerate fantasy books set in our universe. The first time I cracked a Harry Potter novel, I was like, "Yo, is this a documentary?" Pretending that the supernatural is real just drives home how much it's not. But we did. We walked in, we removed our shoes, and joined the circle of women seated on pillows beneath the homemade canopy of red scarves. It wasn't really a tent so much as a pillow fort inside a community center, but it did the job. The women were talking about chocolate, which was such an adorable cliche that I fell in love with them instantly. There is definitely a goddess of chocolate. I read somewhere that the molecular makeup of chocolate is so unique that it was probably brought here from another planet. One woman passed a Hershey's bar around the circle. "This chocolate is even better now that it's passed through the hands of so many goddesses," said the woman next to me appreciatively. There was chanting. Isla, the leader of the circle, said that right now there's an astrological configuration, the cardinal cross, that has not occurred since Jesus was alive, and that she and the other local angel healers are very busy, quote, holding that energy. She explained that the media tells us that things are terrible and violent, but that this is actually one of the most peaceful times in history. We should not focus on the negative. Later, I asked my sister what an angel healer is, and she said, well, you know, angels are just the same thing as aliens. They're probably the ones who brought the chocolate. I asked about the Cardinal Cross, and she told me, oh, if you're going to have a baby, have it like tomorrow. It'll be a super baby. Dude, remind me to send you a picture of the cosmos right now. It's fucking out of control. We went around the circle and stated our intentions for the coming moon cycle. Most of the women had intentions that I didn't understand, that involved manifesting and balance and rhythm. One woman said that her intention was to end rape. I said I intended to organize my apartment and felt mundane. The women totally approved. Total approval is the point of Menci's tent. The press release had promised a place where young women can ask questions and find mentors in absolute acceptance, and Menci's tent delivered. You look different today, said one woman to another. Oh, I know, she replied. It's because I did the 24-strand DNA activation yesterday. I feel like a completely new person. The women around me tittered with excitement. I asked what that meant. She explained that, in addition to our two physical DNA strands, we have 22 spiritual DNA strands which can be activated by a specially trained lady with a crystal wand. The process took 10 hours. There's also a golden gate that you can walk through, she said, but that's more for larger groups. Then another woman explained that DNA activation has something to do with the Mayan calendar. I still didn't understand. My sister didn't know anything about DNA activation, but she did tell me a story about the time she went to see a shaman, and the shaman had a spirit jaguar eat a ghost off her back. That sounded cooler than the DNA thing. Jenny and I thanked our hostesses and hobbled out to the car, thighs asleep and buzzing with pain after hours of sitting cross-legged on pillows. We ate some more jelly beans and talked about our feelings. It's true that I don't believe in most of this stuff, and I suspect that believing is the secret ingredient that makes this stuff work. But it does work for the gracious ladies on the pillows under the red tent, and it was surprisingly nurturing to sit cross-legged in their world for a few hours. And even though I would never phrase it like this, I agree that women don't always get a chance to, quote, fill our own vessels. My dad worked all day. My mom worked all day and then came home and made dinner. Women do a lot. Women are neat. Back at the office, I knew my job was to make fun of Menci's tent, but I just didn't want to. They were so nice and so earnest. What was the point of hurting them? Sincerity is an easy target, but I don't want to excise sincerity from my life. That's a lonely way to live. I used to try to be cool. I said things that I didn't believe about other people and celebrities and myself. I wrote mean jokes for cheap, edgy laughs. I neglected good friendships for shallow ones. I insisted I wasn't a feminist. I nodded along with casual misogyny in hopes that shitty dudes would like me. I thought I was immune to its woo-woo power, but if it hadn't been for Menci's tent, how long would it have taken me to understand that I get to choose what kind of person to be? Open or closed, generous or cruel, spirit jaguar or clinging ghost? A lazy writer? It's easy to hate things. Or a versatile one? I don't believe in an afterlife. We live and then we stop living. We exist and then we stop existing. That means I only get one chance to do a good job. I want to do a good job. Hello, I am Fat. In 2009, I'd been at The Stranger about 5 years, 4 as a freelancer, 1 on staff, and was casually dating a dude who refused to kiss me on the mouth. He's a good person. He was good to me in other ways. They all were, really, even Sasquatch garage door guy. But, you know, we were all raised in the same fucking septic tank. No one teaches young men how to take care of fat girls. The Stranger is the best thing that's ever happened to me. I got to learn how to write and run a newspaper from geniuses, David Schmader, Charles Mudede, Eli Sanders, I'd been obsessed with since I was a teen. We took chances, changed elections, ran our sections with nearly unfettered editorial freedom, and struck a balance between ethics and irreverence that I was always proud of. By the time I got on staff full-time, Dan Savage was already medium famous and had orchestrated a more power, less responsibility promotion from editor-in-chief to editorial director, so he wasn't in the office so much. Nonetheless, the culture of the place was all Dan, and even mostly in absentia, he did the hell out of that job. Dan would run a meeting every few weeks, always our most productive and most boisterous. Be gone traveling for months and then show up at a candidate interview to grill local politicians with the acuity of a day-to-day city hall reporter. Emerge from his office like a groundhog to drop an infuriatingly brilliant mandate about precisely how to tweak whatever delicate story was stumping us. And send insistent emails the morning after every office party to ensure surplus sheet cake was placed uncovered on his desk. Dan has a thing about stale cake. I was taught a mantra my first week to manage my expectations about Dan as an editor. Silence is praise. As long as you don't know he exists, you are killing it. I remember two editors improvising an extensive Dan-themed Gilbert and Sullivan musical number over their cubicle walls. I will laugh at you when you cry. Dan the Great and Terrible. If his management approach is unique, Dan's editorial sense for clear-headed satire and gleeful, pointed disobedience, for where to aim and from what angle to drop the hammer, is unparalleled in my decade of writing experience. Dan knows how to land a point better than anyone I've ever worked with. That preternatural ability is what made him famous. He is a magnificent pundit, and is also what gets him into trouble. Like all of us, Dan fucks up. Like all of us, he is sometimes slow to find the right side of an issue. And when he has an opinion on something, he expresses it in vivid, uncompromising prose to a rapt audience of millions, over and over and over again, because he is as prolific as he is stubborn. He also, like all of us, can be intractable and defensive when criticized, and because he is very funny and very smart, he can also be very snide. And when such a person does actually happen to be wrong, but mistakes totally warranted criticism for petty sniping, and responds not with openness but with sneering acidity to a critic who is just trying to advocate for their own humanity, it can be a very bad look. This is the great curse of popularity and the great luxury of obscurity. People only care about your mistakes when they can hear you. Only failures can afford to be cavalier and careless. Unfortunately for my personal emotional cankers, in the mid to late aughts, Dan was on something of an obesity epidemic kick. He wasn't alone. At the same time that I was tentatively opening to the idea that my humanity was not hostage to my BMI, the rest of the nation had declared a war on obesity. They'd whipped up a host of reasons why it was right and good to hate fat people. Our repulsive, unsexy bodies, of course, the classic, but also our drain on the healthcare system, our hogging of plane armrests, our impact on the children, our pathetic inability and or monstrous refusal to swap austerity for gluttony, like thin people who, as you know, are moderate and virtuous in all ways. Oh, and our health, because they care. They abuse us for our own good. Do you know what is actually not a good way to help a group of people, it turns out? Advocating for their eradication. Dan was on that train, and I don't blame him. It was a very popular and, I imagine, gratifying ticket at the time. And even more so than today, it was considered very roguish to tell it like it is about fat people, as though that wasn't the status quo, as though we hadn't gotten the message. I understand. I had only recently snapped out of some of the same thought patterns myself. I had to learn how to look at pictures of fat people, and I am one. The problem is, fat people are an extremely suboptimal boogeyman, the roots of America's obesity epidemic lying largely in systemic poverty and agribusiness, not in those exploited thereby. The problems with America's fucked up healthcare system stemming entirely from America's preposterous healthcare system, not from people attempting to survive within it and use a service they pay tremendous amounts of money for. New research finding that it's a sedentary lifestyle, not size, that correlates with increased health risks, and fat people turning out to be people whose lives are impossibly complex snarls of external and internal forces, and who do not, in fact, owe you shit. As Kate Harding and Marianne Kirby wrote in their book Lessons from the Fatosphere, health is not a moral imperative. However, it is easier to mock and deride individual fat people than to fix food deserts, school lunches, corn subsidies, inadequate or non-existent public transportation, unsafe sidewalks and parks, healthcare, mental healthcare, the minimum wage, and your own insecurities. So, personal responsibility was de rigueur, and my boss was on board. It was the same bunk you were hearing everywhere around that time. Imperious declarations about fat people's delusions and gluttony, soaked in plausible deniability about health. Dan's main sticking point seemed to be fat people, like me, who insisted we weren't imminently dying. He fiercely and persistently defended his, quote, refusal to take the self-esteem-boosting, public health-shredding position that you can be obese and healthy, end quote. In one 2004 column, the root of a whole pantload of his fat phobia accusations, Dan got grumpy about women, particularly obese people, wearing low-rise jeans, and dismissed the impact that stigmatizing language has on young women. Quote, it's an article of faith that we can't talk about how much crap we're eating, or how awful we look in low-rise jeans, without inducing eating disorders in millions of silly and suggestible young women. Our obsession with anorexia not only covers up America's true eating disorder, we eat too much and we're too fat, but it also hamstrings efforts to combat obesity, a condition that kills almost as many people every year as smoking does. Eating disorders, by way of comparison, lead to only a handful of deaths every year. If you're truly concerned about the health and well-being of young women, worry more about the skyrocketing rates of obesity-related diseases in young people, like type 2 diabetes, and less about the imaginary link between anorexia and my low opinion of low-rise jeans. End quote. Okay, man, we get it. You are not into those pants. More than anything, though, this passage from his 2005 book, The Commitment, sums up the overall tone of his stance, at the time, on fatties. Quote, 2 days later, in a water park in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, I came to a couple of realizations. First, anyone who denies the existence of the obesity epidemic in the United States hasn't been to a water park in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. The owners of water parks in the U.S. must be saving a fortune on water and chlorine bills. Floating in the deep end of the wave pool with DJ, Terry observed that there was an awful lot of water being displaced. If the South Dakotans floating around us all got out of the pool at the same time, the water level would most likely have dropped 6 feet. End quote. We are horrible to look at. We are in the way. We are a joke. I could probably have dealt with that. After all, it really was coming from all sides. But in an unanticipated side effect, a few perspicacious trolls made the connection between my fat body and Dan's fat phobia. Comment sections on any post about fatness were their own kind of horror, having my workplace host sentiments such as, quote, I wouldn't fuck with these people. They might sit on you and crush you to death. If they can catch you, of course. Best bet, run uphill, you'll induce a heart attack, and the pursuer might even roll back downhill, taking out the other members of the fat mob. End quote. Didn't exactly make me feel supported. I started to get comments here and there asking how it felt to know that my boss hated me because of my body. I knew Dan didn't hate me. We had always gotten along. He made me a writer. And sometimes I even earned the vocal kind of praise. But if that was true, why didn't he give this thing a rest? Why didn't he see that when he wrote about fat people, he was writing about me, Lindy West, his colleague and friend? Why should I, as an employee, have to swallow that kind of treatment at my job, in the same newspaper I was sweating blood into for $36,000 a year? What's more, what about our fat readers? I knew there were people reading the blog, clocking the fact that I wasn't sticking up for them, as though I was tacitly okay with what Dan was arguing. It implied complicity and self-hatred. Did I want to be the kind of person who didn't fight? Crop tops, short shorts, no kissing on the mouth, the whirr of the garage door, Beth's flowers, my perfect blood work, the trolls, a year in a basement talking about fucking Sasquatch. I don't know why they don't just find out what it eats and then go to where that is. All of it, a lifetime of it, finally foamed up and spilled over. Something lurched awake inside of me. They talk to you that way until you come out as fat. They talk to you this way until you make them stop. I emailed Dan privately in November of 2009. In my memory, I asked him to please, please consider his words more carefully before writing about fat people, to remember that we are human beings with complex lives, not disease vectors or animals. I begged him to extend some compassion to the fat people on his staff, and to imagine what it might feel like to read your boss parroting the same cruel words and snide insinuations that have been used to hurt you and hold you back your whole life. I was timid, pleading. Or at least that's how I remember it. While writing this chapter, I looked up the original exchange, and it turns out that my memory sucks. Here's the actual email that I sent to my actual boss. To Dan Savage. Subject: Hello, could you lay off the fat people shit? Just curious. Who are these hordes of fat people chasing you around insisting that eating pot pies all day is awesome and good for your health? Because, I don't believe you. That sounds like a straw man, and I know some of your best friends are fat or whatever, but you sound like a bigot. Also, your super fucking obvious and regressive point has been made. Everyone in the world already thinks fat people are lazy and gross. We get it. You are not breaking new ground here. And just so you know, on top of the trolls who call me a fat, cunty virgin every day of my life, now I also get trolls asking me, how does it feel to know your boss thinks you're a disgusting cow? Being fat is its own punishment. I don't give a shit if you think I lie on the couch all day under the Dorito funnel. I'd just rather not be abused on the internet from inside my own workplace. Just a thought. Love, Lindy. Oh, past self, you are completely nanners. I mean, let's be honest, I was really popular. I knew they wouldn't fire me. Dan's reply was 9 words long. He asked, simply, if I'd ever detected any animus from him personally. Nope, not at all, I wrote. Not my point at all, either. He said he heard me, but I was accusing him of being a bigot. A serious charge against someone exhibiting, by my admission, no animus. It was a dodge. He was deliberately missing the point. So then I really went for it. Sorry I hurt your feelings? My points again. Being fat is its own punishment. Every day. Fat people know they're fat and that the rest of the world thinks they're disgusting. Have you experienced pop culture recently? You are crusading for a stereotype that is already the majority opinion. Why bother? Why is that interesting? There is no army of fat acceptance warriors poised to overthrow the earth and force feed you gravy. Don't worry. All the stereotypes about fat people are solidly intact. I'm being sincere here. I don't really think you're a bigot. I just think you're acting like one. This is a really painful thing that I wake up with every morning and go to sleep with every night, and I'm not even that fat. Dan never wrote back. We never talked about it in the office. He couldn't really be mad, could he? The whole ethos of The Stranger, an ethos that Dan built, was editorial freedom, thoughtful provocation, and fearless transparency. Dan taught me to be bold and uncompromising, to confront bullshit head on, to cultivate a powerful voice and use it to effect meaningful change. I learned it from watching you, Dan. I learned it from watching you. For the next year, he went back to posting semi-regularly about the horrors of the obesity epidemic with no discernible interruption, and I went back to ignoring him. Then a whole lot happened in the same week. I dumped No Kissing on the Mouth guy. I kissed, on the mouth, the man who 4 years later would become my husband. Then Dan wrote a slog post entitled Ban Fat Marriage, using the supposed health risks of fatness as leverage to skewer some GOP dodo's argument that gay marriage should be illegal because gay people supposedly die younger. Quote, even if it were true, even if gay people had lower life expectancies, which we do not, and if that fact all by itself was a justification for banning same-sex marriage, why stop with gay people? Iowa should ban fat marriage. There are, according to the state of Iowa, more than 1.4 million obese people living in Iowa. That's nearly 30% of the state's population, and those numbers just keep rising. The social costs of Iowa's obesity epidemic are pretty staggering, and those costs include premature death and lower average life expectancies for Iowans. End quote. I get the point. I understand that, in context, Dan presents ban-fat marriage as an instructive absurdity. This post is still dehumanizing. It still oversimplifies the connections between size and health. And, unfortunately, some anti-fat bigots actually have suggested that fat people shouldn't be allowed to have families because of the children. Mainly, though, if you have a track record of treating my struggle with persistent disrespect and dismissal, then my struggle is not yours to use as a flippant thought experiment. I threw up a quick slog post. Re-ban fat marriage. Hey, Dan. So now that you're equating the stigmatization of fat people with the stigmatization of gay people, does that mean you're going to stop stigmatizing fat people on this blog? Nothing. I waited a few days. Nothing. I looked back over our old email exchange, remembering how scary it had been to send, how roundly he'd dismissed me, and how quickly he'd gone back to posting fatphobic rhetoric. Passively attempting to earn my humanity by being smart, nice, friendly, and good at my job had gotten me nowhere. My private confrontation with Dan had gotten me nowhere. Literally telling him this harms me had gotten me nowhere. Taking a quick, vague swipe at him on the blog had gotten me nowhere. So I did what, honestly, I thought Dan would do. On February 11th, 2011, I wrote a scorched earth essay and, vibrating with adrenaline, posted it publicly at the tail end of a sunny Friday afternoon. The post was called, "Hello, I Am Fat." It included a full-body photo of me, taken that day by Kelly O, our staff photographer, with the caption, "28 years old, female, 5'9", 263 pounds. Remember that, at this point in my life, I had never self-identified as fat except in that single email exchange with Dan, and in private conversations with trusted friends. Even then, I spoke the word only with shame, not power, never in public, never defiantly. Something had snapped in me the week of this post. This was a big deal, a spasm of self-determination rendered in real time. This was the moment. It read as follows, now with a few annotations and cuts for brevity. This is my body. Over there. See it? I have lived in this body my whole life. I have wanted to change this body my whole life. I have never wanted anything as much as I have wanted a new body. I am aware every day that other people find my body disgusting. I always thought that someday, when I finally stop failing, I will become smaller, and when I become smaller, literally everything will get better. I've heard it gets better. My life can begin. I'll get the clothes that I want, the job that I want, the love that I want. It'll be great. Think how great it'll be to buy some pants or whatever at J. Crew. Oh man, pants. Instead, my body stays the same. There is not a fat person on earth who hasn't lived this way. Clearly, this is a terrible way to exist. Also, strangely enough, it did not cause me to become thin. So I do not believe any of it anymore because fuck it very much. This is my body. It is mine. I am not ashamed of it in any way. In fact, I love everything about it. Men find it attractive. Clothes look awesome on it. My brain rides around in it all day and comes up with funny jokes. Also, I don't have to justify its awesomeness, attractiveness, healthiness, or usefulness to anyone because it is mine, not yours. Footnote. I've noticed that a lot of people have trouble with the basic definition of fat acceptance. They want to argue and nitpick about calories and cardio and insurance and health and on and on and on. And if you are one of those people wallowing in confusion, fret no more. I can sum it up for you in one easy-to-remember phrase. Get the fuck off me, you fucking weirdo! Print it. Laminate it. Be it. I'm not going to spend a bunch of time blogging about fat acceptance here because other writers have already done it much more eloquently, thoroughly, and radically than I ever could. But I do feel obligated to try to explain what this all means. I get that you think you're actually helping people and society by contributing to the fucking alp of shame that crushes every fat person every day of their lives. The same shame that makes it a radical act for me to post a picture of my body and tell you how much it weighs. But you are not helping. Shame doesn't work. Diets don't work. Footnote. Fatphobes love to hold this assertion up as evidence of how delusional and intractable fat activists are. Calories in, calories out, they say. Ever heard of thermodynamics? I've never seen a fat person in a concentration camp. High five, Trevor. Leaving aside the barbarism of suggesting, however obliquely, that, well, at least concentration camp victims weren't fat, no fat activist who says diets don't work is suggesting that you cannot starve a fat person to a thin death. Rather, we're referencing the rigorously vetted academic conclusion that traditional diets, the kind that are foisted upon fat people as penance and cure-alls and our entry exam for humanity, fail 95% of the time. Whether fat people fail to lose weight due to simple laziness and moral torpor, or because of a more complex web of personal, cultural, and medical factors, those numbers are still real. Those fat people still exist. Pushing diet culture as a cure for fatness does nothing but perpetuate the emotional and economic exploitation of fat people. Shame is a tool of oppression, not change. Fat people are already ashamed. It's taken care of. No further manpower needed on the shame front, thanks. I am not concerned with whether or not fat people can change their bodies through self-discipline and choices. Pretty much all of them have tried already. A couple of them have succeeded. Whatever. My question is, what if they try and try and try and still fail? What if they are still fat? What if they are fat forever? What do you do with them then? Do you really want millions of teenage girls to feel like they're trapped in unsightly lard prisons that are ruining their lives? And on top of that, it's because of their own moral failure. And on top of that, they are ruining America with the terribly expensive diabetes that they don't even have yet. You know what's shameful? A complete lack of empathy. And if you really claim to still be confused, nuh-uh, I never said anything, you guys, seriously. There can be no misunderstanding shit like this. Quote, I am thoroughly annoyed at having my tame statements of fact, being heavy is a health risk, rolls of exposed flesh are unsightly, characterized as hate speech, end quote. Ha! 1. Rolls of exposed flesh are unsightly is in no way a tame statement of fact. It's not a fact at all. It's an incredibly cruel, subjective opinion that reinforces destructive, paternalistic, oppressive beauty ideals. Footnote. In his response to this post, Dan took me to task for cherry-picking that quote, explaining that he wasn't mocking the flesh rolls of fat people specifically. He was mocking the flesh rolls of all women who wear low-rise jeans without having the correct bodies for it. Oh, okay. FYI, feminism isn't super jazzed about men policing women's clothing choices either. Also, it was totally about fat people, you liar. I am not unsightly. No one deserves to be told that they're unsightly. But this is what's behind this entire thing. It's not about health, it's about, ew, you think fat people are icky. Ew, a fat person might touch you on a plane with their fat. Ew! Coincidentally, that's the same feeling that drives anti-gay bigots, no matter what excuses they drum up about family values and, yes, health. It's all ew. And sorry, I reject your ew. 2. You're not concerned about my health, because if you were concerned about my health, you would also be concerned about my mental health, which has spent the past 28 years being slowly eroded by statements like the above. Also, you don't know anything about my health. You do happen to be the boss of me, but you are not the doctor of me. You have no idea what I eat, how much I exercise, what my blood pressure is, or whether or not I'm going to get diabetes. Not that any of that matters, because it is entirely none of your business. 3. But my insurance premiums. Bullshit. You live in a society with other people. I don't have kids, but I pay taxes that fund schools. The idea that we can somehow escape affecting each other is deeply conservative. Barbarous, even. Is that really what you're going for? Good old-fashioned American individualism? Please. 4. But most importantly, I reject this entire framework. I don't give a shit what causes anyone's fatness. It's irrelevant, and it's none of my business. I'm not making excuses, because I have nothing to excuse. I reject the notion that thinness is the goal. That thin equals better, that I am an unfinished thing, and that my life can really start when I lose weight, that then I will be a real person, and have finally succeeded as a woman. I am not going to waste another second of my life thinking about this. I don't want to have another fucking conversation with another fucking woman about what she's eating or not eating or regrets eating or pretends to not regret eating to mask the regret. Oops, I just yawned to death. If you really want change to happen, if you really want to help fat people, you need to understand that shaming an already shamed population is, well, shameful. Do you know what happened as soon as I rejected all this shit and fell in unconditional love with my entire body? I started losing weight immediately. Well, la-di-fucking-da. Footnote. If I had to do it over again, I would write this last part more clearly, because I think the way it stands undermines my point a bit. What I was trying to convey was that if anti-fat crusaders really want what they claim to want, for fat people to be healthy, they should be on the front lines of size acceptance and fat empowerment. There's hard science to back this up. Shame contributes measurably to weight gain, not weight loss. Loving yourself is not antithetical to health. It is intrinsic to health. You can't take good care of a thing you hate. The post went up. I left the office early and went across the street to get a head start on our Friday afternoon ritual, ham grab. So named because it consisted of getting drunk as fast as possible and then descending upon a meat and cheese platter like a plague of locusts with journalism degrees. As the comment section churned away, 200, 300, 400 comments, I heard nothing from Dan all weekend. Unbeknownst to me, he was off the grid in a cabin somewhere with no cell or internet service. It would be a jarring welcome back to civilization. Oops. The following Monday, Dan posted his response. It was three times longer than my piece, 2,931 words to be exact, accused me of ad hominem attacks and being blinded by my own emotional problems, and featured, as its centerpiece, this condescending bit of armchair psychology. Quote, "It sounds like you're externalizing an internal conflict about being fat. You're projecting your anger and self-loathing onto me and seeing malice and bigotry where none exists. And perhaps that's useful because that anger seems to be liberating and motivating. If having your own personal boogeyman on slog helps you conquer your shame and love your body, and this helps you break out of old self-destructive patterns and habits, you can't be losing weight now just because your attitude changed. Then I'm happy to be your own personal boogeyman. But honestly, Lindy, you don't need one. You're stronger than that." End quote. He said a lot of other things, too, like, "The bigotry in my post exists only in Lindy's imagination," and, "There are crazy fat people out there, Lindy. Be careful who you crawl into bed with now that you're a brave hero to the FA movement," and approvingly quoted a commenter who suggested that, "Apparently Lindy isn't very good with reading comprehension." It was exhausting. It just felt so static and pointless. We hadn't moved an inch. The next day there was a staff meeting about how I'd hurt Dan's feelings, with no mention at all of the climate that had led me to write the post in the first place. I was livid. I thought about quitting, but the stranger meant everything to me. It was the place where I found my voice, and the family that emboldened me to use it. At the time, I couldn't imagine anything beyond that office, and besides, I loved working for Dan. So I dropped the argument. I'd said my piece, I stood by it, and a lot of people agreed. And we fell back into a normal routine. Gotta get the paper out. Meanwhile, I started getting emails from fat people, both friends and strangers, telling me that my post had made their lives better in small ways, emboldened them to set a boundary of their own, or take in their reflection with care rather than disgust. To this day, those emails make my job worth it. A few weeks later, Dan and I went out for beer and soft pretzels to make sure we were cool. "It's like," I said, "here we are at this restaurant. Say both of our chairs are broken." "Okay," said Dan. "If my chair collapses under me right now, people will assume it's because I'm fat. But if your chair collapses under you, it's because you sat on a broken chair." "Okay. Do you get it?" "I get it." I never wanted an apology. I just wanted it to be different. And after all that, it was. While writing this chapter, when I went back and read Dan's response for the first time in years, I was shocked at how dated it feels. The Dan I know in 2016, I don't see much of him there. Whether I had anything to do with it or not, he writes about fat people differently now. When someone asks him for advice about body image, he reaches out to a fat person, sometimes me, for input. When fat people would make an easy punchline, he doesn't take it. We as a culture discuss fat people differently now, too. If you go back to just 2011, 2010, 2009, let alone 2004 or 2005 when Dan was writing about the Sioux Falls water park and low-rise jeans, the rhetoric, even on mainstream news sites, was vicious. Vicious was normal. It was perfectly acceptable to mock fat bodies, flatten fat humanity, scold fat people for their own deaths. You only have to look back 5 years to see a different world, and by extension, tangible proof that culture is ours to shape, if we try. Obviously, there's no shortage of fat haters roaming the internet, the beach, and America's airports in 2016, but an idea has taken root in the hive mind. We do not speak about human beings this way. I tell this story not to criticize Dan, but to praise him. Change is hard and slow, but he bothered to do it. Sometimes people on the defensive rebound into compassion. Sometimes smart, good people are just a little behind. Why fat lady so mean to baby men? I'm on hold with the FBI. I clack out an email to a customer service rep at MailChimp, simultaneously filling out boilerplate help desk forms for Twitter, Google, and Yahoo. Intermittently, I refresh my email and skim through hundreds and hundreds of spam letters. Confirm your subscription for Subscribe to HTML Plugin, European Ombudsman Newsletter, Pot Weird Zenny Prenumerati Newsletter TVP.pl, tweezing out legitimate messages from my agent, my editors, my family. I know I'm missing things. I'm probably losing money. When the emails started trickling into my inbox that morning, I'd thought little of it. Some days are spammier than others. Around 10 a.m., the trickle swelled to a flood, and then a creepy tweet popped up, too. Email me at toiletperson@thetoilet.net if you want the spam to stop. I simply want you to delete an old tweet. I sigh, scrubbing my face hard with a dry palm. Does this have to be today? I was gonna write about my abortion today. The receptionist from the Seattle FBI office picks up. Hi, I say. I have a problem? I'm already grasping for words. How do you explain to someone who might not even know what Twitter is that you're being anonymously extorted via email newsletters into deleting an unspecified past tweet? Beyond that, how do you convince them that it actually matters? My understanding of the FBI is 90% X-Files. As far as I know, they're off trying to solve Sasquatch crime, and here I am begging them for tech support. It does matter, though. It's costing me time, potential income, and mental health. If you consider Twitter part of my work, which I do, it is tampering with the journalist's email to coerce them into pulling a story. It is, I think, illegal. More significantly, though, it's part of a massive, multifarious online harassment campaign that has saturated my life for the past half decade, and on a broader scale, is actively driving women off the internet. Disruption, abuse, the violent theft of time, then writing about it to illuminate what we go through online, this is my whole deal now. Unsurprisingly, the tweet that the toilet wanted deleted turned out to be a screenshot of a rape threat I'd received from a popular troll. He was harassing me to scrub Twitter of evidence of my harassment. The FBI receptionist, sounding bored, I know the feeling, says she can't help me. She tells me to call the Washington State Patrol, which seems weird. It is unmistakably a brush-off. I call the number she gives me, and nobody picks up. I drop it and try to get back to work. There is no recourse. I didn't set out to make a living writing about being abused on the internet. As a child, I was really more looking for an open position as, say, the burly and truculent woman at arms protecting an exiled queen who's disguised herself as a rag and bone man using cinder paste and some light sorcery. Or a flea-bitten yet perspicacious motley urchin who hides in plain sight as a harmless one-man band jackanapes in order to infiltrate the Duke's winter festival and assassinate his scheming nephew with the help of my rat army. Is that hiring? Any overweening palace stewards who are secretly a pumpkin-headed scarecrow transfigured by a witch want to join my professional network on LinkedIn? I was an avoider, an escaper, a fantasist. Even as an adult, all I ever wanted was to write jokes, puns, and Game of Thrones recaps. Instead, here I am, sitting at my computer, dealing with some fuckface's insatiable boner for harassing women. Earlier, when I said the violent theft of time, I meant it. Online harassment is not virtual, it is physical. Flooding in through every possible channel, it moves and changes my body. It puts me on the phone with the FBI. It gives me tension headaches and anxiety attacks. It alters my day-to-day behavior. Am I safe? Is that guy staring at me? Is he a troll? It alienates my friends. It steals time from my family. The goal is to traumatize me, erode my mental health, force me to quit my job. Anytime I complain about Kevin's harassing me online, no matter how violently, sexually, or persistently, someone always pipes up with this genius theory. Rape and death threats are part and parcel of the internet. You just can't handle it because you're oversensitive. Footnote. I call all anonymous internet dill holes Kevin, not because I think Kevin is a bad name, you know I love you, my Kevins, but because, being from the Home Alone generation, it's just so easy to hear a fed-up mom screaming it up a staircase. Kevin! What is a Brazzers and why is it on my bank statement? Never mind the fact that coding sensitivity as a weakness is bizarre. What do you think this is, the Ministry of Magic under Voldemort's shadow government? It's also simply out of step with reality. You can't do this job if you have an emotional hair trigger. Undersensitivity is practically a prerequisite. I was at the stranger for the advent of comments, but prior to the ubiquity of social media, so I sat through several years of relatively innocuous variations on hipster douchebag before my readers ever discovered what I look like, where I was vulnerable. In retrospect, it was bliss. I never took those comments home with me. They were cumulatively tiresome, but they didn't sting. I think of my first real troll as the first person who crossed that line from the impersonal into the personal, the first one who made me feel unsafe, the first to worm their fingers into my meat life and attack who I was rather than what I wrote. At the time, I covered movies and theater. I didn't write anything political. I didn't write about being fat or being a woman. My name is gender ambiguous, and for the first few years of my career, many readers thought I was a man. People's assumptions tend to default to white and male, especially when the writer is loud and unapologetically critical, and sharp around the edges, which was kind of my brand. Not that women aren't naturally those things, any more or less than men are, of course, but we are aggressively socialized to be nice and to apologize for having opinions. So, while the tenor of my commenters was often snide, disdainful of the stranger's snotty teenage brand of progressivism, they stuck to hating the message, not the messenger. Those years were liberating in a way I can barely imagine now. To be judged purely on ideas and their execution, not written off by people with preconceived notions about fat female bodies and the brains attached to them. Now I spend as much time doing damage control, playing whack-a-mole with my readership's biases against my identities, fat, female, feminist, as I do writing new material, generating new ideas,